It's time for what Podcast International called the greatest podcast in history. Open your ears, because it's time for Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.
All right, everybody, you are listening to Man Thoughts with Brian the Kid Callen. Thanks to everybody who came out to see me in Minnesota, Minneapolis. You guys are so big and blonde and meaty. All right. I will be, by the way, before we kick this off, I'm going to be in Calgary, October 11th, 12th, and 13th. That's a Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I love Calgary. I don't know what you people are about in Canada, but you're a blast and you always come out in droves. I think we sold out every show last time. So I'm hoping for more of the same. We got a whole new act and I'm excited. Without further ado, back by popular demand is none other than the man himself, my father, Michael A. Callen, Michael Anthony Callen. And your podcast, I know you were just talking, but the podcast seemed to really hit a chord with a lot of my listeners. I got more feedback, more positive feedback. I think almost 100,000 people have downloaded it. I got more positive feedback than I have from any other podcast. And so that was kind of exciting. So I wanted to get you back on here. And now that you're visiting me from your humble abode in Park City, and I wanted to, further the conversation and have more of a talk about what makes you tick. And we were just talking about, we're going to cover the election. I want to get your point of view on the election. I want to get how you would moderate that debate and whether or not, what questions you'd like to ask Romney, what questions you'd like to ask Obama. But let's talk about what we were just talking about, which is the power to change. You're 72. You've had to make changes in your life. Just not only on the workplace, but in your personal life. And let's talk a little bit about, because there are a lot of young people that listen to this, and I think a lot of people suffer from, I notice a lot of people suffer from this sort of disease where they define themselves along very specific and strong lines. A lot of times those lines have been given to them. Well, you're not good at math. You're more of a left brain guy or something. Or no, you're not athletic. You wouldn't be good at jujitsu. You're made to paint or whatever. And I think that we subscribe to how we have been defined, and we subscribe to, I guess, even what's expected of us. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, I'm not asking you to be a self-help guru here, but maybe you can talk a little bit about what your point of view on human potential is, and what you'd say to young people about how to kind of maybe break some of those habits.
I don't think that people resist change. I think that people resist injury. If the change is an increase in your income, I've never seen much resistance to that. But if the change is something you consider an assault on your self-esteem, then we get reactions that surprise everybody. There was a case study I used to teach in my teaching career in the Harvard Library called The Road to Hell. And without going into any detail on what it was about, the teaching guide to it has made a powerful impression on me. And I taught this first time, I think, probably 20 years ago. In general, the approach to understanding what was going on in the case was to recognize that we can all observe and describe fairly accurately behavior. Some of these outrageous cases of people shooting innocents and so forth. We can all describe what happened there. It was tragic. It was horrible and so forth. The next thing we have to understand, which is not all that difficult to discern, is the feelings that prompted that behavior. Anger, rage, serenity. It depends upon what the behavior was. And then underneath that, there's only four steps to this. Underneath that is the perception of the person, of the doer, that caused the feelings.
And so, in other words, the the person that, say, comes into a theater and shoots a bunch of people. You're talking about
the suicide bomber. If you take extreme cases.
Yeah. What their perception was of the world, in other words.
How their perception, they were looking at very much the same thing that you and I look at. But they had a totally different perception of the same thing.
Okay.
And then the last step, which is very difficult, which is why we have psychiatrists, and there are, for all the jokes, some good ones, who are trained to dig into this. The last one is the assumptions that you carry around with you all your life that are formed at a very early point in your life. So that
it's a belief system, isn't it?
Yeah, it comes out to be a belief system, and you were probably taught that. Or it may be that you had experiences in many cases. Let's take a random example of one that I... And you've got to be very careful drawing conclusions here. That's what the case demonstrates, because people often confuse perceptions with assumptions. Assumptions would be things like deeply held religious beliefs. An example I always go back to, Elizabeth Warren is running for the Senate in Massachusetts, which is a very left-wing state.
And Elizabeth Warren, I think, was a professor at Harvard.
Harvard Law Professor. And a lot of television time, the media had
Yeah, they wanted to make her the chairman or the president or the czar of the Consumer Protection Agency.
That's correct. That would have been just wonderful. But she comes from Oklahoma.
You're being sarcastic when you said that would have been wonderful.
You're not kidding. I mean, the Senate blocked it. That fight Obama didn't want to have. But
I want to have that conversation. I want to come back to that before you finish this point. I want to come back to why that was.
Elizabeth Warren's parents in Oklahoma, in the days of the Dust Bowl, when we had very bad economic times, had their home foreclosed on. And since then, Elizabeth Warren, by her own admission, hates bankers and banks. Not the person whose assumptions and perceptions were formed from that kind of an experience, and the world is full of those kinds of experiences, but that's probably not the balance that you would want to have running a consumer protection, because there are probably, and I'm not picking on Elizabeth Warren particularly, she'll probably be the next senator, given that she's running in Massachusetts, but I'm not picking on her in particular, but it's a good example of somebody whose behavior is being driven by things that she may not even understand.
Yeah.
And certainly would not admit.
The trauma of seeing her parents' house taken away from them and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're all a product of that. I mean, you're bringing up a good point, because we are all a product of our past scars, our traumas, our victories, what's been told us, our culture. And that, I think, the antidote to that, the way to bring all of those forces into balance so that you become a sober decision maker, so that you become someone of wisdom, is ultimately what? Education. Learning to read the right things, jogging your own paradigm. It's why I always tell young people, you got to read. You've got to immerse yourself in the best that's been thought and said. If you don't know what that is, then actually start taking a look. Start educating yourself. I don't care if you go to Coursera and you take a course online, whatever it might be.
A broad set of life experiences. One of the things that disturbs me about our current president, who I think is a well-intentioned and intelligent man, is if you look at his resume, people laugh about this now, but the only thing he ever listed was community organizer. So Barack Obama has never been in an environment where you had to compete to succeed. Competing to get people to come and take your service or your product versus somebody else's service and product, where it was a matter of economic survival. That's a very good part of life experience. You don't have to spend your whole life doing that. I think you should spend your part of your life in philanthropic kind of things. I think people that go to Africa and the Peace Corps are very important. And by the way, they usually come out of those experiences a little differently than they went into them.
They come out of those experiences. I've talked to a lot of people who come out of those experiences. They go in very idealistic. They come out hard realists.
Right. And I think that if you really got into his soul, the current occupant of the White House would clearly describe profit as there's something unseemly about it. But yet profit, and the more profit you have, the higher living standards you'll have for everybody. And the only way...
However, I will say that in today's environment, we've touched on this before, People probably don't disagree with that in this country. What they are worried about is that the profit's going to a very small minority who have all the power. And I think most people in this country, from what I gather, and I travel enough just to do these polls, feel, and I feel this way, feel underrepresented, feel powerless, feel as though they are just, they're not even a squeak in the fray. You know, there's nothing you can do. That's where I think Americans are frustrated. That's where, you know, all of us are.
I happen to share that feeling about the size of government. I don't feel that way about a private sector firm.
Right.
Because on a daily basis, I see firms going out of business all the time.
Yeah.
I go to stores I used to frequent going out of business. What's wrong?
Blockbuster, you know, Fry's. And a lot
you
of
go through
it. Stores.
There's an endless list. And as we discussed it last time, I'm still looking for the government agency that's outlived its usefulness or never accomplished its mission that went out of business. That's never going to happen because there is no competition. If you were to say, I want one word from you that made the United States the richest country in the world, that one word would be competition made it that way. And behind that is the idea that the consumer, you're saying, feels so powerless is making those decisions on impersonal way.
Yeah. And remember, one of the things that people, whenever I talk to people on the left, what they want to do is they want to bring government, a centralized authority. And we have to be fair to them. These are not bad people. But the idea for a lot of people is essentially to even the playing field. The problem with evening the playing field with a centralized bureaucracy, whether it's the federal government, the state government, whatever it might be, the problem with that is that, like anything else, there will be competition within those government agencies. There are people in those agencies that will find a way to get more power. It's how human beings are. So you're actually just creating one problem with another problem, as far as I'm concerned. But the other issue with having the government do that is, you're right, there is no accountability. They become all powerful, and that's not the American way.
Well, I would also point out this weekend, Apple sold 5 million new iPhones.
Yeah.
I know there are people on the left who don't think they should have been permitted to do that. That the people buying those iPhones are not really getting value. They're paying for it. $200 an iPhone. They're not really getting value. That money should be used in different ways. The idea of these people being intelligent enough to exercise their right to liberty is not very high on their list of values.
Right.
So Apple, by definition, is going to have the highest sales it ever has, the stock price now over $700. It's the Microsoft of today. And that that's not evening the playing field because they have such enormous advantage because of the imagination, service, and product they're providing to the consumer. Everybody on this podcast has been in an Apple store. How about that? What is that about? You walk into
an
Apple store.
They make a great product.
Make a great product and back it up with phenomenal service.
Yeah.
There are people who have told me Starbucks should be put out of business. I've actually had people say that. And I say, why? Because they're providing a product, coffee, which is a commodity, and they're charging $4.50, $5 for it. The question then is, why are people standing in line? The same attitude of Walmart. Up until a year ago, I'd never been inside a Walmart. I'm now inside a Walmart, and I can't believe it. I just cannot believe it because of the prices I'm used to paying versus what Walmart wants for the same subject.
And a lot of people argue eloquently that, you know, and I was one of them, and I still am in some ways, that Walmart comes in and they destroy the organic fabric of a town because so much of Main Street came up with family-owned businesses, buildings that had been there for, you know, 400, you know, whatever, 100 years, 150 years, and businesses have been passed down generation to generation, say a hardware store, and then Walmart comes in and they're giving you hammers for 50 cents, whereas the other hardware store has to stay in business by charging a dollar, you know, $3, $50 for a hammer, or whatever it may be. And I know that really Walmart, I really do sympathize with those towns that feel like they've died off. The fabric of the town has been ripped apart by this behemoth company that comes in and hires people from out of state because it's one of their policies. They want you, et cetera, et cetera. I understand that sentiment. However, I also understand the fact that Walmart is just a product, a manifestation of the fact that we are living in a global economy now. We are not living in a local economy. We are living in a global economy. In other words, if you have a product that you produce, you are competing with all the other people in the world, not just in this country, not just in your town, who have a product for sale, a similar product. It's just like me as an actor. Let me tell you, when I go into a room, 15 years ago, I was just competing with guys who came to LA who are American. Now, when I go into a room to audition for something, I'm competing with everybody in England, everybody in Australia, everybody in South Africa, everybody who can speak English well and can do an accent. And so the role goes to the best man. I don't mind that. I am truly living in a competitive global marketplace. And I can tell you right now, I could list it for you just in this year, the roles I've lost to English and Australian actors. Guess what? They might be, I don't agree with this, but according to the producers, they were the best guy for the role. And that is the reality of the world we live in today. If you have a problem with it, and if you think the government's going to come in and save you from that, you're going to be in trouble. The only way to survive in this economy, the only way to survive in this world, in my opinion, is to be malleable, to embrace change, and to recognize that, hey, man, there ain't no second place. You got to just be on your toes. And if you have a skill set that's not relevant, well, guess what? You better get to work on a new skill set. That's the way it is. Sorry.
The Walmart argument you've just articulated reminds me a bit of a feeling I have when I fly in airplanes today versus when I used to fly. And once or twice in your life, young man, you flew in a private jet with me because the corporation was footing the bill. Otherwise, I was flying first class.
You hear that, folks?
Place.
I flew in private planes.
Now, when you get onto an airplane, I remember the day when the flight attendants would have white gloves and serve you champagne and come and massage your neck and all. That was luxury air travel. Very, very few could afford. Everybody can afford it now. So when you're against
Walmart, they can't afford a massage, but they can all afford to fly. That's for sure. I fly coach.
when you say what you just articulated about Walmart, that is an elitist argument in the worst case, because they have 300 and some billion dollars. I guess I've lost track. 1,300,000 employees. What have they got up in the over 50 million customers every year? And most of those people, the employees and all those people that come in and buy their goods, are not rich. They're not well-off people. They didn't go into the hardware store and pay $1.50 because they couldn't afford it. They can't afford the 50 cents. So we've got a very happy development, and what I call the soft argument about it used to be nice walking down Main Street. You can do that in Bronxville. By the way, last point on this, I'm not at all sure, but I haven't done the homework, so I'm not going to spout. I'm not at all sure those nice, organic, soft, friendly hardware stores have been eliminated, because I know a number of them just in my recent 2-year experience, which are around. I like shopping in them as opposed to Walmart. By the way, the one thing that Walmart surprises me for is its size, its massive scale, and how nice all the employees are. That surprises me.
It's a very well-run company.
Well, I mean, Sam Walton is probably one of the most famous people. But incidentally, I mentioned on our last podcast,
Sam Walton's the guy who started Walmart?
Yeah.
And what do you think makes him so good as a businessman? It's just consumer first and realized
Sam Walton was famous for saying, is there any way I can make this a better experience for the people that shop with me? And he would call every other retailer and he'd say, hi, I'm Sam Walton. I got this little place down here in Bentonville where he started. I was in your store the other day, and I am just amazed at how quickly you can cash out a customer. How in the devil do you do that? And the people he would be talking to at that store would say, oh, yeah, and they'd tell him everything they do. And within a week, Sam Walton would have that in his store. Now, here's an interesting tidbit from a business school professor. The reason that Walmart got its huge start has to do with management information. they used, they were the first with a bunch of things we now take for granted. For example, if they ran out of a size of a certain product, they would immediately reorder without human intervention. It would immediately reorder that size. It would go directly into their supplier. The other thing they were famous for is they had a different set of products in Spring Hill, Tennessee, than they did just 100 miles away in Louisville, Kentucky. It would be totally different.
That's right, because every state has different needs. I mean,
every little community has different
needs. They were talking about Magic Johnson had a lot of Starbucks in black neighborhoods.
Yeah, they're the ones, said, by the way, that told us the Chinese, when they went to China, don't buy checkered shirts.
Yeah.
Who knows why? Nobody well, that,
that's
knew that
like Magic, Magic Johnson. He owned a bunch of Starbucks franchises. I think it was Starbucks, and he said, "My folks, the people in these black communities, are not going to eat what white folks do. A lot of times, they're not going to have these snacks. They want something different." So Magic Johnson, for example, put sweet potato pies in some of his stores. They sold like wildfire. Cultures, black, Chinese, black, white, they are different, and they require different services. They like different things a lot of times. They like the same thing a lot of times, but there is an American character, but there's also, there are subsets within all our cultures, and if you want to stay in business, you better be catering to who the bulk of your clientele is, that's for sure. I kind of know that as a stand-up comic. You know, I tailor my act depending on where I am sometimes. Luckily, I'm hilarious across the board.
I'd like to make a point because one of the current topics is Clint Eastwood's performance at the Republican convention. And he mentioned there that not everybody is a hot dogger in Hollywood. There's a lot of people around that community who are on the right side instead of the left side. There are a couple of very famous left-siders who are very vocal. In fact, the book that Laura Ingraham wrote, Shut Up and Sing, became a bestseller. And I don't want to mention a name, but I think everybody is aware of who I'm talking about. I have a very good friend, the CEO of a major company that was a really hot company, and I don't think it's appropriate to mention that name either, but they had an initial public offering, which means they were going to sell stock to the public for the first time, and there was huge demand for the stock. Guess who called him personally? One of the most prominent left-wing profiles in Hollywood because they wanted to make a killing.
Yeah.
I mean, in some of the, there's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides, but when you see it up close, it's absolutely.
Everybody wants to make money, man. People would do a lot for $1 million.
Yeah, but my point is, this is money you didn't work for. This is one of these sure things, the kind of things where they give a congressman, this guy Foley, who was Speaker of the House from Washington, had to end his political career because he kept getting these broker dealers saying, hey, we've got an allotment of 200,000 shares, Mr. Congressman, Mr. Speaker, and we've got 50,000 set aside for you. And everybody knew you'd get it at the allotted price that day for $5 and sell it 2 days later for $15. And that was very nice. But yeah, they weren't doing him any favors, were they?
No, they wanted a favor in return.
Well, they, of course, and it was like a personal contribution, not a campaign contribution.
Well, now that we're talking about campaigns and we're talking about politics, let's move over to Romney and Obama. And I know that you're a libertarian, so you have your issues with both candidates, of course. I have my issues with both candidates. But let's talk a little bit about Romney's background. And I hear a lot of people criticizing, you know, Romney, like the Obama campaign for his performance with Bain Capital. The knock on Romney is that he outsourced a lot of work, that he got government bailouts, government guarantees to keep his company afloat. And I've read some of that stuff, and I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. But I wanted to get your take on your point of view as somebody who is at the top of the business world. You've met Romney, and you know a lot of people that know Romney very well. I want to get your take on, and I know you're not a Mormon. I know you have your issues with somebody who's a Mormon. And by the way, there's a lot of misconceptions about Mormonism. For example, the polygamy is not legal in Utah. That was made illegal, and that was made essentially, that was banned from the Mormon Church, I think, in 1890. So there's
banned
a lot
by the federal government.
Yeah, there's a lot of misconception about Mormonism. In fact, Mormons for the most part are very, I also want to touch on I want to touch on the riots in the Middle East. You know, in fact, before we get into Romney and before we get into Mormonism, I want to just say a couple things about Mormons, and they're favorable. I'm not a religious guy. I certainly don't believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, but I do think that. By the way, I believe in the Constitution, which means I think religion should be a personal issue between a man and his God. Call me crazy. It's what I think. That's why the Republicans lose me all the time. But having said that, let's just take, for example, I want to give you guys my take on what's going on in the Middle East. Some moron, I guess he's a Coptic Christian in Egypt. He's Egyptian. He makes a terrible movie. It's not even a movie. It's a 14-minute horseshit, you know, thing, insulting Islam and the Prophet Muhammad. And all these people in the Middle East are taking to the streets. First of all, I want to say I don't believe that is a profile of the average Middle Eastern or the average Muslim. Remember, I think Lady Gaga sold about 550,000 tickets in one of these countries. So they're not that pious. They're probably a lot. I think the average Arab has a lot more in common with the average American than we think. And, you know, these people that are taking to the streets like this, in my opinion, are not Muslims. I don't even think they're believers. If they were believers, if they really believed in their religion, they wouldn't find a 14-minute YouTube film that nobody saw threatening enough to take to the streets, light cars on fire, and kill people. Okay, so they're not believers. But more importantly, I resent the fact that our government officials, like Hillary Clinton, like Barack Obama, are even apologizing or even talking about how disgusting this film is. What we should be doing is defending free speech, freedom of expression, which the Arab world could use a lot more of. It is to their detriment that they hold Islam so precious. There's nothing wrong with Islam as a religion. It is one of the great religions, okay? And by the way, I've read the Quran. But so there's a lot to be said about Islam and everything else. But the fact that, you know, the fact that these people are taking to the streets, what the Arab world needs more of is freedom of expression and respect for other people's opinion, which includes giving people the right to criticize and even insult what you believe. That is what makes our country great. And it's time that the average jamook in the street lighting cars on fire learns that and realizes that. I happen to believe the people that stormed our embassy in Libya and killed those three Americans are not Muslims. They're criminals. They're criminals, and that's the best I can say about them. I don't believe they're believers. I don't think they're Muslims. I think they're criminals. And I think what would have solved the problem was a helicopter gunship, okay? Because that's what they were. They were a well-organized army with heavy machine guns and RPGs. So fuck them. That's what I have to say. Sorry about being that was my little tirade. But I want to also say something. I want to bring it back to what we're going to talk about, because remember, guys, there's something called the Book of Mormon on Broadway, okay, that Hillary Clinton saw. And it is so hard to get into. You can't get into it. I was in Minneapolis. I tried to get tickets in Minneapolis. I couldn't get in. Okay, there was a line outside the door. And it's all about making fun of Mormons. In fact, there's a scene where somebody takes the Book of Mormon and sticks it up the other guy's ass. Okay, do you see Mormons killing people? Do you see Mormons taken to the street and burning cars? No, you don't. No, they had a very concise statement. The Church of Latter-day Saints said, we actually believe that it's an entertaining musical, but we also for a day, but we believe that our teachings and the Book of Mormon can change your life forever. Now, that was their statement. These people are secure in their belief system. From what I've seen, I've never been hit in the face by a Mormon. I've never been insulted by a Mormon. From what I've seen, Mormons tend to be people who go out and help a lot of other people that are not Mormons. It's part of their mission. So I just wanted to say some nice things about the Mormons, and I happen to believe that Muslims, not all Muslims, but the Muslims that are taken to the street could learn a great deal from the Mormon example. Anyway, that was my, I had to just go off on a tangent there. Thank you for listening.
Okay, you covered three or four subjects in that passionate statement, which I think passionate statements are important. one, I'd like to go back to Mitt Romney and my experience with him. Mormonism, 5 points. One, Mormonism is a non-issue for me, whatever his religion. I am older than anybody listening here, I think, at 72. But remember, therefore, very, very well John Kennedy winning the West Virginia primary.
And he was Catholic. That was a huge
Catholic
deal.
And that is a watershed event in American political history. Then went on to win the presidency. So Catholicism, and he made a very famous speech to a group of Baptist ministers in Houston, which was another watershed. And that campaign changed forever the view we had of Catholics running for office, because there was a strong attitude that the Pope would make all the decisions, which of course was based on ignorance. And there is an enormous amount of ignorance, but mainly spoken by ignorant people.
But by the way, there are a lot of highly educated people on both coasts that love making fun of Mormons and are really insulting about it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people
it's an acceptable prejudice.
Well, I'm not sure it's acceptable. Certainly not. No prejudice is acceptable. This is a particularly bad one. I don't see it any different than prejudice of other kinds. But my point on Mitt Romney is that if you talk about moral character, where you've got a personal code of how you're supposed to live your life and how you're supposed to interact with other people, we probably haven't had a president as defined in that respect as he is, whose personal behavior mirrors his public persona since, if I go way back, it's hard for me to remember. There are others, because that was probably Woodrow Wilson. The idea that Romney could ever behave the way Clinton did in office, and one of my great disappointments in public discourse today in the United States, is that Clinton's a hero in many quarters and a moral leader because of the way he behaved with Monica Lewinsky and many, many other people. The double standard was just absolutely screaming, and I've never quite understood it, because he's an attractive guy, and John Kennedy before him.
I think Clinton also earned some respect for his work with AIDS in Africa and his work with the poor.
Give it all to him. His personal behavior and his personal principles, he's got to be ranked among the lowest presidents when it comes to that. But that,
along with John F. Kennedy, by the way.
John F. Kennedy, no doubt about it. And Lyndon Johnson, by the way. But that was probably as degrading. It was worthy of a French president. And it's just not a part of the American
tradition. I'm not as puritanical as you are. We've had this discussion. I'm not.
No, it's not
There's good evidence that Gandhi and Martin Luther King both cheated on their wives, but nobody's talking about
it. Well, I'm sure they
did.
We're
all flawed.
But
right?
It was not morally acceptable, and it's not something that was you praise because gave in to his appetite as president of the United States in his office. And was carrying on. And yeah. I'll tell you something else about that episode. I don't want to stick on that. We're talking about today. A man who had the flawed judgment to consider a 21-year-old girl capable of keeping a secret.
Yeah, but that I bet she gave a
great blowjob. By the time this all came out, she'd told 12 people. What would you expect?
You can't do that. Yeah, if you're the president, you can't have a 19-year-old blow you and expect her to keep her mouth shut. Come on, Bill.
But he did. He must have thought that his appetite.
At least wear a disguise.
His appetite was so totally.
Sure, but I would have worn a fucking mask. Now you can't blame me now. And don't get so messy and leave a spot on the dress, you
moron. And then we have this very convenient, self-serving, well, he compartmentalizes. When he's getting serviced by some 19-year-old, that's different than when he's making foreign policy decisions. You can believe that if you want.
I've just never heard the same tale after a while.
Mitt Romney is a very upstanding and moral person. Let me give you one quick anecdote, because we live within a mile of a house he sold in Park City. The person he sold it to, I met, and he said, this is before the guy was running for president. This is 3-4 years ago. And he was working at Bain Capital. The day that it came for us to take over the house, it's a very nice house, he was there. He took us all around, spent 3 hours showing us everything in the house. I've never had a better experience. Contrast that.
He was saying Romney did that for him?
Romney did that personally. And he said he had nothing to gain. The deal was done. He had the money and all that. He spent all this time going through all this detail, taking us all through these papers. My wife and I couldn't believe it. Contrast that with my personal experience, your mother's and mine. We just bought a house a year ago in, as I say, a mile from there. We've never met the people that sold this to us. And now we're in a lawsuit, first lawsuit I've ever filed, about some things that they didn't tell us about that it cost us $200,000 to repair. But that, Romney is a man from anybody I've met who is a very upstanding character. So I think
I feel the same way about Obama, by the way. I think he's a man of upstanding character, and I think he's a well-intentioned, good man. But that's you need more than that as a leader. You need wisdom. And I think that the biggest thing on people's minds is the economy. And I find it interesting that people are if you wanted to get hard-balled about it, you know, I have trouble voting for a guy like Romney with his, you know, his pro-life position and his foreign policy rattling his sword at Iran. I just personally have an issue with it. But let's just talk a little bit about the fact, though, that he's a stud businessman. I mean, his reputation as a good businessman. I've talked to real business people, not actors and things. I've talked to people in the business who happen to think he's a very smart guy and is responsible for not only creating a lot of jobs through Bain Capital, but that Bain Capital was an excellent company. Are you of that point of view?
100% of that view. And he didn't do anything he shouldn't have done. And if I were an investor in Bain Capital, and he didn't do some of the things he had to do to succeed, I would have been very upset with him.
Because he chose to do the right thing.
The key thing you said is he created a lot of jobs, which is absolutely correct. He created a lot of jobs. Without Bain Capital,
does it bother you he only paid 14% tax on his taxes?
That's another thing. I pay as little tax as I can within the law, which is what he did. Yeah. There are some... When you are in a venture capital business, most of your gains are coming from capital gains. And capital gains are taxed at a lower rate for a good, sound reason. Now, Obama thinks it's not fair to do that.
It's a good, sound reason because you want people to invest in new businesses. If they didn't invest in new business
Let's underline a statement here. The government does not, I'm going to say this again, the government does not create jobs.
It doesn't, I know.
The private sector creates jobs. One of the things about this campaign...
Well, the government does create jobs, and I'll give you a couple examples. For example, when the government, the Department of Defense orders 50 fighter jets from Boeing, that creates jobs. So government spending does create jobs. And my problem, Romney was a little bit, you know, he says the same thing, but then he says, well, if we're cutting defense, we're cutting jobs. So there is...
I mean, when you have a need for military equipment and the government for that purpose goes out and orders that equipment and has a bidding process from private sector companies, the end result is creating jobs. I'm talking about something else. When the president gets up in front of Congress or in front of the American public and says, we've got a jobs program, and so the government's going to do something specifically to create jobs. Mm. They don't create jobs. The private sector creates jobs. Even economists on the left admit that. This has got to be debunked. And the guy that debunked it was Milton Friedman. And I've been in economist conventions where the idea of the government creating jobs.
You know, it's a little bit like...
What question would you ask Barack Obama? I would ask Barack Obama about... his assertion that we're going to get, by the time the next election comes around, we're going to get the unemployment rate down to 5%. And look at my stimulus program for $850 million. That was a massive misallocation of resources, what it really was. And we'll see that in the due course of time. But we're not at anything like, we still got 23 to 25 million people unemployed in this country. He never, ever believed that was possible. And I know some of his advisors, like Larry Summers and others. The question I'd have to ask him is, Mr. President, 4 years have passed. Your intention when you signed that bill and expectation was something totally different than we've got. What do you know now you didn't know then? Mm. And I don't want to hear the name George W. Bush.
You don't want him blaming George W. Bush or Republican filibusters, etc.
Well, what he's going to say in the debates, you'll see, first one's October 3rd, he's going to say the problem was much worse than we thought it was.
Okay.
And what did George W. Bush do to make it such a terrible problem? Tell me specifically. Now, there's an overview to this whole thing. The overview is this. Thank God it's this. The White House has reasonably little to do with the economy.
That's right.
And the Congress. They can screw it up.
They can screw it up, but they have very little to do with you know. And you were talking about, by the way, you were talking about this. There's a book called This Time is Different, written by a Harvard and Yale professor.
David Rogoff and Carmine Reinhardt from the University of Chicago. David Rogoff from Harvard.
Right. And I asked my father, I said, you know, I was with Dove Davidoff as a comic. We were eating dinner, and Dove said to my father, how do we avoid a crisis like we had in 2007? How do we avoid a huge financial crisis? There are answers to that. But for the most part, this book written by these two that sort of everybody is reading now in the know, talks about the fact that financial crises have always happened. There have always been, you know, bubbles, and then they've always burst in 1906 and even in the 1800s. I can't remember the exact date, but there were always there. And
20, 30 years.
You can chalk that up to human optimism, and more importantly, you can chalk it up to new market forces, new forces in the world, things that just happened nobody saw coming. And then you have people who are adjusting to that. Nobody expected China and India, for example, to rise as quickly as they did, to buy into the American housing market, etc. I mean, these are things that we were getting
ready
for.
When Deng Xiaoping decided that China was going to become capitalist and get rich, and he added 500 million new laborers to the world labor market. Now, you tell me what you think is going to happen as a result of that. I'll tell you one thing for sure.
That's
one thing for sure
is
iPhones cost $200 instead of $800, and you go down an endless list of the benefits consumers get. Hmm. But consumers are not organized, are they? Did you ever hear of a consumer union? I don't think you did. We are all consumers. The labor unions who were impacted by this, because there was going to be a reapportionment of labor skills as a result, the masses benefited greatly, even though it's hard for them to see. The labor unions in certain areas got hurt, and they're organized, political, well-financed organizations. But they don't speak for the American public. They speak for their members.
You know, it's funny because I equate this to my life, you know. My problem with unions, my problem with anybody who manipulates the marketplace, my problem with anybody who says, well, you got to create jobs. We have a government stimulus job program, or we're going to create jobs, or we've got to stop this. My problem with you as an individual, either are able to fill a need or you're not. If you can't fill a need, I'm sorry. If you can't fill a need, or you may fill a type of need that pays you $6 an hour, or a need that pays you $600,000 an hour. That is up to you as an individual to come up with a way to do that in the world. I know it's not fair. I know life isn't fair. I know the playing field is not equal. I know that, man. I know a kid born in Crenshaw, a black kid born in Crenshaw, is starting behind home plate where I was born on third base. I get that, man. There are inequalities in life, just like there are inequalities in nature. Now, there are ways to even that playing field. I have my own point of view on how that is, and other people do as well. But let me give you an example of how life works. People say, are you going to be in Hangover 3? Well, I got to put you in Hangover 3. Look, man. That script was written by Todd Phillips and maybe somebody else. What mattered was that they make the best movie they possibly can. If the inclusion of a character I could play, whether it was Eddie or the guy from the second one, the strip club owner or someone else, if there was a part for me that was going to make that movie better, then I would have gotten a call. But that's what dictates whether or not you get a job. Was Brian Callen able to provide value and make that movie better? In this case, I don't think so. I'm not going to argue with Todd Phillips. Seems to me that guy knows how to make a movie.
You mean you're not going to be in Hangover 3?
I don't know. I haven't gotten
Jesus.
A call.
Jesus. I mean, I know. I had no
but
idea.
That's how this business works.
I can call a senator. Could you? Yeah.
Do you have any influence? Can you strong arm Todd Phillips?
Absolutely. The hell with all these movies. What do the movie viewers know? We want to get you in the Hangover.
Exactly.
I didn't know that. It was shocking.
Exactly. And what I would do if I was a company in today's world is I'd hire special interest people to strong arm Todd Phillips into giving me a part.
Damn right.
That's very similar to what it is when you try to make jobs and make Toyota hire people that are not qualified or that are not providing value or that are not creating a product that the consumer wants. That's how
I would like to make a point. I think many of our listeners have watched the Democratic National Convention and saw the ex-governor of Michigan, a woman whose name, again, I'd feel more comfortable leaving out, but everybody knows who it is. She became totally unglued and was swinging around in a 360-degree arc, screaming and yelling into the microphone about the Obama administration bailing out General Motors and Chrysler. By the way, they didn't have to bail out Ford. Strange, huh? Bailing them out. So they saved all these jobs, and she would scream, Ohio, 69,000 jobs. There was nothing more ridiculous that I have seen in public discourse than this idiot. And thank God she's not the governor of a state anymore. Here is the key point. The Obama administration bailout of General Motors is not what saved General Motors. There could have been a prepackaged structured bankruptcy, and all those jobs would still be there. The equity holders would have been wiped out, which is the appropriate way these things should happen. The bondholders would have become the new owners of the company, and they would have continued on and emerged under bankruptcy law, free of a lot of their liabilities, by the way, including their labor contracts. All the Obama administration did was to say, no, 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 we don't like that allocation of resources. We're going to put government money in here, make the unions the new owners in a major part, and maintain the pay scales that have proven uncompetitive. I will grant this. General Motors is beginning to make some very good vehicles. Their Cadillac and a couple of their others, I think their Buick, are getting very good reviews. But that's what counts, not the fact that there was a political deal cut in the White House. That's ridiculous.
So General Motors and Chrysler, in your opinion, did not need that bailout. That was a political decision.
Mitt Romney, in fact, wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal, which is being distorted, which he, I think, understands it would be, saying we can have a structured bankruptcy here and bring these companies back very, very healthy and competitive. Washington didn't do that. They said, no, this is an opportunity to grant the new ownership to the unions, who brought the problem to where it was in the beginning. The management was terrible, too, by the way. And when you get government support...
Well, I think the United Auto Workers Union was basically negotiated retirement packages that gave retirees 95% of the salary they were making. I mean, what business can stay in? That's where the private sector gets just as crazy as the government. I mean, that's where unions price themselves out of the market. I'm in a union, by the way. I love my union. I love SAG. I love AFTRA. I need them. They do a good job. I don't know who runs SAG. I don't know how they do it, but they're so impressive to me. So I'm not bashing
unions. You should belong to a union. There's nothing wrong with an organized.
What's wrong? Yeah, until unions price themselves out of the market. That's what unions have to be.
Then the company they work for should go bankrupt.
That's right. But by the way, unions. Every union that gets involved in government, whether it's public safety unions or whatever, bankrupt themselves as well. Bankrupt the towns that they service. For example, see the state of California. You know how many counties in this state are bankrupt because they can't afford their retirement packages?
I mentioned a little while ago a landmark in American political history. Another one nobody noticed, I doubt it made page 85, was John Kennedy signing in 1963 an executive order giving public service workers the right to unionize. What you have now, and there are articles in the press every day, note the one in the Wall Street Journal this morning, about the ability of municipalities to carry the pension liabilities and the health care costs they have. They don't have the ability. And by definition, they have to balance the budget.
Say that again.
Years ago, the unions and the public service side organized. They're right. That's fine. And they came to their municipal mayors and aldermen.
Municipal guys meaning the town.
Towns and cities. By the way, there are 88,000 different municipal units in the United States, independent. I'm talking school boards, sewer authorities. There's 88,000. And about 50,000 actually borrow on their own by issuing municipal debt. I'm talking now as the chairman of AMBAC, which used to guarantee
explain
a lot
to people
of
what you mean by municipal debt and what that means by borrowing.
Santa Monica wants to build a sewage plant, wants to build a new road through part of it, and it goes out and issues bonds to the public.
In other words, yeah, it issues, you can buy these bonds.
Right.
It's like an IOU, and then the government will pay you back in interest.
Okay, right. So you guys but the interest you receive on municipal bonds is not taxable at the federal government level.
Okay, so it's not taxable, so you get a tax.
That's the difference between these are called tax exempts.
That's why that's why they call them munis. That's why municipal bonds and a lot of people's portfolios are.
And it's a huge market, right? Yeah. Now, what governments did, and the local governments, is exactly what Greece did. They sat down and they negotiated with the unions. The union said, we want better pension benefits. We want better health care through death for our whole family. Here is the imbalance and the problem we ran into. If you're doing that with a company, the company says, this is coming out of my profit margins. I won't be able to compete. You're asking too much. You'll drive me out of business. I will not do it. There's a strike. There's some kind of a settlement within the confines of reality.
Yeah.
The problem with the municipality is
you can borrow.
The guys who were going to pay all this, the taxpayer, were not at the table. It was a mayor who didn't want labor war. And he was only in office for 2 or 3 years. He's not a taxpayer.
And they were all.
He's supposed to represent the taxpayers, but he never took their interests into account. So what we ended up with is across the country, municipal unions, people that who nobody would consider their job all that challenging necessarily, were getting more than the private sector was because the discipline wasn't there. Yeah. Now they have to pay the piper. Because now all these retirees are saying, pay me my 95% of my salary. New York City is a classic example. And the current mayor is saying, I don't have any money.
Well, that's
Harrisburg, right. Pennsylvania declared bankruptcy. Jefferson County in Georgia declared bankruptcy. Stockton County in California declared bankruptcy. We can't pay.
Well, how? What do they do then? Now, does the federal government comes in and bails them out?
No. The federal government cannot constitutionally come in and bail them out. Barney Frank would love to do that because the taxpayers are an endless source of his political favors, but he's retiring from Congress, and I think we're all better off. But the only thing they can do is say, where is all this money going? And the answer is, all of this money we're paying out is going to pensioners and healthcare contracts we had. And the
because, by the way, you were able
saying, we have no choice but to cut your pension in half.
Yeah, because you were able to retire at 55, sometimes 50.
There was no discipline.
In fact,
sometimes you could work three jobs.
If you worked 20 years on the force, whether it was police force or something, or I think being a fireman, and God bless the cops and firemen, by the way, I love them, but they negotiated some pretty strong, you know, you could work, I think it was 20 years and get a pension for life.
This is what the whole Scott Walker issue in Wisconsin was about, where they got a recall. We want to continue milking taxpayers with no constraints. And they got enough people to sign. Wisconsin's a left-wing state. I grew up there. They got enough people to sign, and the people said, let's have a recall election. And Walker won 54-46. I could never have been more delighted in my life because reality sometimes dawns.
It dawns.
And he excluded that police and fire.
It already is dawning. I mean, this recession in a lot of ways has brought people.
Well, you know, if you promised some people you employed, nannies, housemaids, and so forth, they're going to pay them $10,000 a month. Guess what? You're going to come to a day, whether it's 3, 6, 9 months, you're going to come to the day when they come and say, where's my $10,000? You're going to say, I don't have any more money.
That's right.
I can't pay you. But you promised. But there's a written contract.
That's where math comes in.
Show me where I get the money I promised to pay you that just isn't here anymore.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah. That's right.
That's a rather useful discipline to have in place.
Well,
it works.
It's called reality. It's called nature, right? It's called coming up against that wall.
So the Bain Capital idea for Mitt Romney is a non-issue. His Mormonism is a non-issue. Biggest issue with Romney is his flip-flopping. And I think somebody said on the left, I don't see why any woman would vote for a Republican. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an issue that the Republican Party hasn't addressed. By the way, if you look at the electoral map, Obama's the president. I mean, he's going to be president for another 4 years. I don't think that's as terrible as some of my friends do. And the Republican Party, more than Mitt Romney, has to address some key issues. This country is no longer going to take a religious point of view on abortion, for example. It's no longer going to take a religious traditionalist point of view on same-sex marriage. And if the Republican Party doesn't get past that, they're going to be an afterthought. And that's a tragedy, because those are not the issues on which we should elect.
I know. I don't give a shit. Like, let men marry men if they want, and legalize drugs. Who gives a shit if you want to fuck off in a corner and do a bunch of drugs? Just we'll zone it and we'll tax it. I know it's more complicated than that, but how is the war on drugs going, everybody? How is that going, besides the fact that we've incarcerated about 1 million people? You know, I mean, I really do feel like I can never vote Republican, because I don't want to tell my friends I voted for somebody who wanted to restrict a woman's right to choose. I have gay friends because I'm in the show business, and I don't want to tell my gay friends that they can't get married and that's who I voted for. I can't do it. Yet I agree with the Republican notion of smaller government and marketplace economy and all that, because I'm a libertarian, as are you. So that's the bummer about it. You're right. I mean, they're losing me in that sense. I don't even like their anti-immigration stance for the most part. Every time I hear a guy like Hammony, Sean Hammony, or even Bill O'Reilly, or, you know, and I've read two of O'Reilly's books, but God, Ann Coulter, whose books I've also read, who I can't stand, but I read her books at least.
Well, those are extremists.
I mean, these are extremists, but
I don't think.
But they lose me, man. They lose me. I feel like they're just... they're not understanding. I feel like they're just bullies.
Hannity is an unreconstructed Irish Catholic. I was one of those. I understand his sentiments.
Sure.
I don't agree with the fact that he's made no progress. I've got to go back to a point you made a second ago, because you went through Bain Capital. You touched on the North Pole, and then you bounced back to... but anyway, you were talking about the Arab world, where I lived for 10 years. And if I feel comfortable...
you lived in the Arab world longer than that, didn't you? 10 years?
A total of about 10 years. Okay. I've never really added it up day to day. And by the way, I consider Pakistan part of it. We lived there. And then my consulting work in Jordan and Saudi Arabia and all that.
What Arab countries have you been to?
I've been to all of them.
You've been to Iraq?
Yeah, sure. In fact, you know, one of my claim to fame is I met Saddam Hussein, but that was back in the 70s. They used to have the Majlis, and we were dealing with their big government-owned banks. And the guy said to me, next time you come, we have to meet the, what do they call him?
The emir, or the
no,
his excellency.
No. The head of the Revolutionary Command Council. I forgot the name they had for him. I said, sure, you know, that the Arab world, you do that kind of thing all the time. That's how I met.
But you've been to Jordan, you've been to Syria, you've been to...
all of them. There's no country I haven't been to. Okay. Anyway, and Libya a number of times. I used to go all the time, because we had their money. Citibank did, and I have responsibility for that. But, and so you would... go into the Majlis, which he would hold every Friday. So we arranged that I went and sat and talked to him. And the thing that came out of that the most is he would speak in Arabic, and he would be translated. And as he was speaking in Arabic, I'd kind of look around the room where all of his henchmen were, and they'd all be nodding their heads before I even knew what he was saying. And that tells you that you've got a situation that could be very dangerous, because whatever he'd say was right.
Sure.
And what he did was he lost all touch with any reality.
You're talking about Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
And that happens.
Oh, he was also a sociopath. I would also add that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have many views in that respect. But I can just tell you that if you disagree with him and then you got shot, within the day you would be tending to agree with him, or the people that weren't shot and were still living would be there.
Well, didn't you tell me that I think the German ambassador to Iraq came to meet the ambassador to Germany, and they said, well, unfortunately, he was accused of crimes against the state, and he was shot, and he said, well, can I go see his children to pay my respects? And they say, well, unfortunately, they've also been shot. I think you told me.
Yeah, but that kind of thing happened. I think that can be exaggerated sometimes, but yeah, no, he did. He would do that. He had unquestioned power, and for... somebody like that, the only thing that counts is loyalty.
Yeah.
And any sign of disloyalty, which means disagreeing with him. Now, his perception, we were talking before, and I want to go back and say, remember, it's behavior, feelings drive behavior, perceptions drive the feelings, and all of that is based on the assumption underneath it. And he would take it extreme. I just want to emphasize this. I'd like people to remember, because it was one of my great life lessons. The assumptions you carry around are not immediately obvious to you. They have to do with your religious beliefs, and that's where all the passion
your
comes from.
Cultural beliefs,
that's where all the same-sex marriage, and that's where the abortion passions come for, where people are killing each other, because it goes back to really deep in childhood, your formative years on all of these things. If you're a suicide bomber, it's because you really do believe you're going to get all these virgins in a few minutes. You know. Now, I want to go back to the Middle East. You said the terrorists and Libyan. Yeah, I think I agree with you on the Book of Mormon. I agree with all those points. There are other examples of where we have tolerated making fun of certain groups, and all of a sudden we become very understanding to the point of denying our own Constitution, and I think that's disgusting. The key thing to bear in mind, and I make this speech in Utah all the time the other day at a luncheon speech, is it is not the general Arab nation, your point. It just is not the general Arab nation. These are a bunch of wild-eyed, misguided fanatics who will give up their lives happily.
Yeah.
And we, because of the nature of fanatical Islam, which is the only one true faith.
And there is something called fanatical Judaism and fanatical Christianity, by the way.
They tend not to be going around and killing people.
Unless you're Norwegian and you shoot a bunch of children at a
camp.
Yeah,
and
that's a Christian fundamentalist.
That is, but he was doing that for political reasons.
I understand, but I'm just saying that the fanatics exist in all religions.
Guy probably didn't even believe in God. Who knows?
Fanatics and assholes exist in all religions,
right,
is all I'm saying.
Right. And they're sick people. Now, the Middle East happens to have more and more active ones. And I think this is a stage of their history and development. And unfortunately, you know, two people can keep New York hostage and for a certain period of time. And it's almost impossible to stop from generalizing. But I have seen people very highly educated. One guy with a PhD, and he's done postdoctoral work, not in politics, but in science, made some raving statements asking me a question about Muslims in general. And that's what's dangerous.
Yeah.
That's dangerous. But it's not the case.
Painting anybody with a broad stroke.
By the fact, in Libya the other day, the compound where these fanatics came from was stormed by the people themselves. And when we had 9/11, I was very close to Saudi Arabia, and I was there all the time. And we had a number of their officials and royal family come here, and I would be invited to lunches because I was known in the Middle East in those days. And these guys' main concern, rational Harvard graduates who happen to be Saudi, their main concern was one of Osama's major objectives was to drive a wedge between the United States and the royal family in Saudi Arabia.
Which, by the way, he did a pretty good job of. Yeah, he did a pretty good job. Yeah.
Did a damn good job.
Yeah.
It worked pretty well.
Because we found out that that a lot of Saudi money was being funneled into those madrasas in those religious schools in Pakistan, etc., and the engine behind a lot of this fanaticism was Saudi money.
We got to be a little careful. The Saudis are very religious as a country, and there is no separation of church and state. So they do try to propagate Islam. It's one of their requirements. Now, the madrasas were religious schools where they'd memorize the Quran. I don't think many Saudis who did put money in, like one of the people I was very close to, now deceased, ever thought that they would end up producing terrorists.
Yeah.
But you can't control that. You give money to Romney and he goes out and takes some position you're against. You wish you hadn't given them money.
Sure.
I gave money to Obama in 2008, and I'm very, very disappointed. But
why did you give money to Obama?
I listened to him, his policies. He seemed balanced. He seemed persuasive. I was very much partisan to the fact that we needed a black to be elected to public office. I thought it would do a great deal for race relations, and I think it probably did.
I like that you said a black.
Huh?
A black man. He's half black, too. You could even say, I wanted to give it a, yeah, no, you're right.
Well, I mean, we would be
that
able
was the
to,
reason I voted for Obama. I wanted to make a statement to the world and also just the
and
fact
I think
that,
we did.
Yeah,
I think we
and
did.
I think, and the fact
I didn't
that we
realize
voted somebody
he was
who looks,
so far to the left where all problems have to be solved in Washington and business is a bad thing.
Is that how you feel about Obama?
Yeah, I do. I think he believes that business and people out there to make a profit are really bad.
So he's been a big disappointment to you.
Very, very big disappointment. I mean, I so
George
much
Bush was too, regret. Wasn't he?
Well, Bush was spending way too much money, but despite the fact that you're required, especially in this part of the country, to condemn George W. Bush. I think that was way, way overdone. I don't think he ever departed from the principles that we knew he reflected. I saw him way before when he was not his father's successor kind of thing. I happened to see him because his father couldn't make it to a luncheon. And he came instead, and everybody was disappointed. And I'll tell you, by the end of the lunch, everybody was very impressed.
Always said one-on-one, the guy is, first of all, very funny. He's the guy you want sitting next to you at dinner. He's a lot of fun. But
he had answers. He had knowledge.
My feeling about George W. Bush is that he just lacked wisdom. I really believe that. I don't think he was a curious man. I don't think he traveled. He speaks fluent Spanish, the best I can say. But I think a wiser man would not have allowed himself to get bullied into Iraq, for example. But you know,
I think Iraq was his idea from the beginning.
Yeah, but we were also.
Now you can say, "Oh, that's the crime."
Also hindsight and things like that.
That's the crime. But yeah. I actually think Iraq was more his idea than anybody's. I don't think by the time 9/11 was done, I don't think anybody had in his administration had any choice. And I know people that were in that administration.
Yeah, well, that might be so. We've talked for 1 hour and 5 minutes, Big Mike. And I want to thank you for your pearls of wisdom. I know it's appreciated, and we'll have you back as often as we possibly can. Is there anything else you want to say?
When do I get this check?
No, you're not getting paid for this. You don't get to share it.
Okay.
I'm not even
so
sponsored.
Long, folks.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot for listening to Man Thoughts with the man himself, Big Mike Mancallen. If you got questions for Big Mike, you can just go to manthoughts.com, and I think I have an email thing there. I got to start answering my emails. And I will be in Calgary. Let me go through this one more time. I'll be at Calgary at Yuck Yucks in Calgary. And I will be there October 11th, 12th, and 13th. And then I'll be in Fort Lauderdale October 18th, 19th, and 20th. And I can't wait. Then I go hunting with Mr. Joe Rogan from the 22nd to the 27th. Yeah! I'm going to shoot a deer and eat it. Thank you for listening. You guys rock.
You've been listening to Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.